I'm Chris. I'm an alcoholic.
I'm Chris.
And I'll do a brief recap of the six steps that came before seven. The first step, we admitted we were powerless over alcohol, that our lives had become unmanageable. I was powerless in two ways. Once I started, I couldn't stop. And once I stopped, I couldn't stay stopped. I remember one time I went to the hospital to pick up a sponsee who had just used again. And we were in the hospital room, and the nurse came in to sign her out and all that stuff. And she told her all these things she's got to do because she had, like, low potassium. I don't know. All these things that she needed to do. And then on her way out, she goes, "Oh, yeah, and don't drink again." And I was like, "Thanks, lady. You know, no shit. Don't drink again." Like, that's the problem here. We just keep drinking again. So not wanting to drink didn't do it for me, and it didn't do it for that girl, but she's free today. You know, I like to tell that story. I mean, she went through her grandmother's death, her mother's death, all within her first year, and she's a pretty amazing person. Anyway, so once I start, I can't stop. Once I stop, I can't stay stopped. And unmanageable, my life is still unmanageable if I attempt to manage it. It actually tells me somewhere in like the third step, I think, in the book, it says that we suffer from the delusion that we can wrest satisfaction if we only manage well. So it's actually telling me I'm delusional if I think that my management of my life is going to make me happy, that all I need to do is figure it out and I'll be happy. I'm delusional if that's the way I'm looking at it, that I do need to look to something greater than myself to manage this because I'm not good at it. Came to believe that a power greater than myself could restore us to sanity. If you really digested the idea of step one, or I should keep it in the eye, when I really digested the idea of step one, it was kind of like a blow to the chest. It wasn't like, "Hey, my name's Chris, an alcoholic. Let's go for burger after the meeting." You know, like that would. I don't know what I thought an alcoholic was in the beginning, but that was about as far as I could get. It was a blow to the chest. It was everything I believed about me and alcohol and drugs and how it was going to be in a little while, all those reservations, totally smashed. I'm not saying that I didn't still have times where I wanted to use. I mean, prior to having a spiritual awakening, that happened a lot. But if you're an alcoholic and an addict, it does happen a lot. But my idea that someday I'll be able to use successfully, that was smashed. You know, I speak in a lot of rehabs and whatnot, and I mention, if you guys want to use, that's really not that weird, and that's not a reservation. That's being an alcoholic and an addict. If you think you can, then we have a problem. Because knowing that we can't use obviously isn't good enough. The first step has 11 following it, so just knowing isn't good enough. But so if you really digested, or rather, when I really digested it, there was nothing left for me to do but seek a power greater than myself. And I've shared here before, I didn't like the word God. I didn't believe that there was anything there. I called it Amelia. I felt like I was talking to the wall. And that's where my relationship with God started. And it grew from there. That was good enough at the time. So once I kind of digested the idea that there is a God, I can't say that I exactly believed it yet. But I was definitely willing to believe that there might be something on this planet greater than me. I guess I just wanted to know what it was. And I had to come to the realization that I'm not going to know exactly what it is, that we're not, you know, in a competition to figure out who can figure out what God really is and what he isn't. And I just need to believe that there's something and have some sort of understanding of it. But to be right, I have no idea. And I had to let that go because that was what held me back for a long time. The third step, I was on the third step for like a year and a half, which they warn us against in the book. It says, though our decision's really, really important and vital to us staying sober, it ain't going to last if we don't immediately do a fourth step. So I was stuck on step three because I had a sponsor who had me reading the step book, and I'm just not sure she knew what to do with me because I wanted to do the steps, or I thought I wanted to, and she just didn't quite know how to make me give my will over, you know, and it took a long time for me to realize that I wasn't actually turning my will over. I was deciding to, and that in order to follow through with that decision, I needed to shut up, sit down, and write a fourth step. So that was what happened when I went through the big book with another sponsor. You know, after having that blow to the chest first step experience, finally starting to talk to God, and then getting to the spot where, like, yeah, it would be a good idea if I didn't run my life. So I sat down, I shut up, and I wrote a fourth step. It consisted of four lists, the resentment list, the fears list, sex conduct, and then we try and form a sex ideal for a future sex life. And then it was time to share it with someone, that stuff that I thought I was never going to share with anyone. I shared my first two columns of my resentment list with anyone who was willing to listen. I mean, my first two columns are like, who I'm mad at and why, you know, but getting any further than that, I didn't really understand why, what it affects. It affects me, you know, like that's about as, I couldn't understand what they meant by what does it affect. It makes me angry because they suck. I don't know what you want from me. So it was really a new idea to look at this from this different angle, and now it was telling me that that wasn't really exactly good enough, that I probably got some truth from the fourth step I wrote, but that there was more to come. So I sat down with that sponsor that took me through the book, and we did a fifth step, and we spent the whole day together. And she listened and spoke. She did a lot of speaking. I can't say that I was the only one talking. She shared so much of her experience with me. I shared my experience with her. And something shifted. The idea that I was a terrible, horrible, no good, very bad person turned into I'm a sick person. And there was not necessarily forgiveness that day. I can't say I walked out of there skipping. But within the weeks that followed, the fifth step promises really did come true in my life. I was actually capable of sitting down at peace and ease. And the purpose of the fifth step is to get closer to God. And I had to admit that I was closer to God then than I had ever been before in my life. Even when I had that third step spiritual experience, you know, I was getting closer and closer and closer as I did each step. So it worked. The fifth step worked. Something shifted, and it was time to go home, sit down, shut up again, because I'm not good at that, and read through my fifth step and read through the first five steps of AA and decide, is there anything that I left out? At the time, there wasn't, and I was ready to read the sixth and seventh step. As the years have gone by, there's things I left out that I didn't know existed. I have to admit that. I mean, you stay sober long enough, stuff comes up. I don't know if everybody has that experience, but for me, shit, we'll call it shit, came up. And I needed to do another fourth, and I needed to do another fifth, and I can't say that I left it off on purpose, but I can say that once I was aware of it and I waited to actually do that step, that's when I got kind of sick. Because it was there, now I was aware of it. And that's where, you know, you kind of go backwards through the steps. I mean, by the grace of God, right now I live in 12, but for the last 11 years, I haven't been, like, in 12 every single day. I've had periods of sickness and health. So I went home, sat down, like I said. It was to my satisfaction that I hadn't skipped anything. So I read through the sixth step. The sixth step is basically, am I ready? I mean, I've gone through this thus far. Am I ready to ask God to remove these things from me? And it says if you're not, pray. Ask God to be willing. Basically says that at every step. When we're at the ninth step, pray if you're not willing. Pray if you're not willing. We handle it like every other problem. Pray. So I prayed because there were some that I, you know, even though I would have liked to have let them go, I wasn't capable of letting go, and I didn't see how it was going to be possible. And that's where the seventh step comes in, and this idea of not egotistically deciding myself to remove my shortcomings, but the exact opposite, humbly asking God. So that implies that I can't just decide to get rid of my shortcomings like I did in six and poof, they're gone. You know, I need to seek something greater than myself, even more than I already have. There's a whole lot more work after step seven. Step seven is the physical, me physically saying the seventh step prayer for me, which has the same idea behind it as the third step prayer. I'm asking to have every single defect removed from me, not so that I'm awesome, but so that I can help other people. So that's why we're asking for God's help now. It's not for a selfish reason anymore. There's times where I've prayed for myself to find a sponsee. You know, that's cool. That's not really praying for yourself. That's praying for someone to come into your life so that you can help them. And that's kind of what the third step prayer and the seventh step prayer do. They say, get me out of my own way. Help put the stuff to bed that needs to get put to bed so that I can sit with another person and do this work. Or so that I can be a daughter. you know, it's not just about coming to AA and living here and being a good person here. It's about what happens when we go home. And you know, the seventh step really dealt with a lot of shortcomings that might not pop up in these rooms, but they pop up in my household. So I had a lot of shortcomings that I was willing to have God take. Others I didn't think he was capable of taking, but I did the steps. I asked, and I let it go from there. You know, there's times where I wanted to just get from here to there. Me, now, shortcomings. There, me, no shortcomings. You know, and there's a straight line there, and this weird-ass 12-step way, you know, way out of the way, as far as I was concerned, was what they were telling me was going to work, and that there was a big wall in between me, and I had to go around the wall. You know, and it just seemed way out of the way, but it actually was the only way for me to get to that other side, which, not that I'm free of all shortcomings. He's only removed the ones in the way of my usefulness to others. There's so many that are apparently useful to someone. The eighth step list. The first time I did it, I just basically, she said to me, everyone that you're going to make an eighth step is somewhere in your fourth step. So I went and did my first amends, which was to my ex, which was for all the wrong reasons. You know, I looked pretty good. So I went, made amends to my ex. Anyway, I stopped there, and I remember it was about, I don't know, maybe 5 months later, and I was sitting next to my sponsor, and I was like, I gotta do another fourth step. You know, and she's like, well, where are you with your amends? And I was like, I did one. So she had me reorganize it and into three columns, and it's, you know, ready, maybe later, fuck that. So that's the three columns that I organize it in, and suddenly it made it a lot easier because I'm definitely ready to do some of them, maybe for all the wrong reasons, but I got to do them anyway. Eventually, I'll maybe do them, and I've mentioned I've been sober for 11 years. It was eventually later, you know, and it was eventually fuck that time. I did all the steps that were on my first, I did all the amends that were on my first amends list. One of them took me 8 years to do. I mentioned the first week I was here that I had alcohol poisoning when I was 14. It was the beginning of my alcoholism, I guess, the first time that my body reacted and wanted more. I was on a cruise with my best friend and her family, and I completely ruined their family vacation, and my parents hated her parents from then on because they obviously were terrible parents because I got drunk. They're terrible parents. Anyway, it took me about 8 years to actually go knock on the door and make amends. And the mother wasn't home, but the father was, and he has Parkinson's, and he was like trying to undo this rope or this like hose or something, and I'm sitting there like, what am I, you know, he was like, don't worry about it, he's like, come sit down. So like I helped him untie the rope, the hose, and like that was my ninth step to him. I didn't know what else to do. I had already said I'm sorry, you know, he said no worries, so I stayed around and helped him out, and that was it. Something I put off for 8 years, you know, and I wrote I ended up speaking with the mother at a later time, but there wasn't much I could do outside of that and being sober today. So that eight-step list was then completed, and I had this column that I was ready to do, and I went out and started to make amends. Some of them were a lot easier than others, and I'm talking about beforehand, because once you actually do them, it says in the book, 9 times out of 10 it actually goes well, and in my experience, 9 times out of 10 it actually goes well. So it's not that I was scared. Once I started the amends, it was actually getting the guts up to actually do it, which was a problem for me. And I had to pray a lot. It says, if you're not willing to make a certain amends, pray on it. So I did. I made amends to my sister, whom I drove drunk and high with her in the car. She's about 4.5 years younger than me. I would drop her at my aunt's house so that I could go do coke while our mom was in the hospital because no one was home and she was having a nervous breakdown, 89 pounds, couldn't go to school. As far as I was concerned, a liability I did not need. Drop her off at my aunt's house so I could go snort coke. So I owed a lot to my sister, and a little conversation letting her know that I knew I owed a lot to her wasn't going to cut it. I've been a sister for the last 11 years. And that's what has been cutting it. You know, I really attempt She's one of my best friends today. I have goosebumps. She's one of my best friends today. She really is. And I really didn't even know her when I got sober. I had known her for her entire life, but I didn't know her. I wasn't interested in knowing her. She didn't do drugs. The 5 days I was quarantined in my home before rehab had a bed, it was just me and my sister. My parents had gone out, and she was 14, and I tried to talk her into going to get weed with me. Mom and Dad would let me go if she came with me, and it would be her first time and my last time. I really, really tried to talk her into it, really, and I almost had her, but I didn't, and she didn't. But those are the things. Her well-being, not a concern of mine prior to sobriety. And even in the beginning of sobriety, I was actually worse off than I was when I first got sober because I didn't have a program, and my solution was drugs and alcohol. So I had a lot of amends I had to make regarding things I did in the first 2 years of sobriety, not even prior to that, and I didn't even have anything to blame it on. You know, the usual, I was really drunk, I'm sorry. No, I wasn't. I was stone cold sober, and I did that. I'm sorry. The idea behind amends, and I mentioned it a little bit, like going and just saying to my sister, I'm sorry, isn't going to cut it. You know, as an analogy, if I run through someone's fence with my car, getting out of the car, being like, yo, so sorry. Getting back in the car and driving off ain't gonna cut it. I probably couldn't fix a fence, so I'd probably have to pay for the fence to get fixed or, you know, go buy the materials or whatever it may be, but the action behind it is the real amends. So again, me being a sister was really that amends, and I made amends to my mother, whom I was incapable of being there for while she was sick. And my father and I are like the same. So I don't know if you guys butt heads with that parent that you're exactly like, but a lot of my resentments to this day that still pop up are usually things in other people that I do that I don't like that I do. So you do it, oh, I hate you. So my father is like the personification of all my defects as far as I'm concerned. So we butt heads, and I've attempted to make a verbal amends to him a few times, and it's always ended in tears, screaming, crying. It doesn't really go well. So leave the verbal amends alone, and I've just continued to try and be a good daughter, and that's really all I can do in that situation so far. He's in a program, and he made amends to me, and all I'm doing is sitting there like, you're doing it wrong. So did it wrong. But he did. He made amends to me, which was really cool. One of my favorite amends, I had about six... I had about 6 years sober, and there was this awful person that I hated. Since eighth grade, last time I spoke to her, I ripped her apart, told her never to talk to me again or about me again. Hated her. Awful. Like one of those like mean girls, you know? But she lived on my block, so I saw her all the time. And we never spoke ever again until I wrote her this letter. And I basically said, I'm sorry I couldn't be a friend. The kind of friend I am today, I couldn't be when I was in eighth grade, you know, and I did what the big book tells us to do when you kind of don't know what to say. You know, I'm in AA, and this is part of my work that I need to do. So I wrote her this whole letter, sent it off, and it was probably a couple of weeks later, I got something in the mail, but I lived in an apartment, so all my mail went to the little Irish couple downstairs, and she accidentally opened this particular letter that this girl sent me, and she was like, I'm so sorry, I accidentally opened it. And I was like, you don't understand, you know? I'm like, oh, no problem. I thought it said, like, you fucking bitch, never write to me again, and that, like, now my little Irish, you know, landlord knows everything. And I get upstairs, and I'm like, and it's like this adorable card, and it just says, I forgave you years ago, don't worry about it. You know, I'm a teacher now. I try and teach my students to be a good friend, so it was pretty cool you said that, and if you ever need anything. And I'm telling you, this girl was evil in my head. Like, awful. Probably the worst person ever. And she wrote me a card. Like, really sweet girl. So it tells us also during our fourth step, we don't necessarily have to be right about the resentments that we have. We don't have to have the correct memory of it. Whatever the memory is that's causing the resentments, good enough, and I got to deal with it. Because the memory of her was obviously different from who she was that day. But I allowed it, you know, fancied or real, it says, these resentments. And that one was slightly fancied, I guess. I don't know. I really don't have much more to say on 7, 8, and 9. I definitely just want to reiterate that after I started 9 and didn't continue, I felt like I needed another 4th. And I find that a lot of people kind of chill after doing the first couple amends. I find my sponsees attempt to. Attempt because I'm up their ass because it happened to me. So I try and, like, just let them know if you don't continue to do these amends, you're probably going to start to feel like crap again. And it really goes for every step that we read through and start. If you don't do it kind of immediately, sometimes the effect of the prior step wears off, just like I mentioned with the 3rd. So with that, I'm going to open it up. Thank you for that.